I'm back, everybody. I am mining investor and editor of Resource Stock Digest, head out of the Del Real, here with my partner, Mr. Nick Hodge, who, by the way, did a phenomenal job last week with the podcast. Enjoyed that a lot. Thank you, Nick, for holding it down. As you all know, Nick is also an investor and the publisher of Bizarro World. This is the 376th episode of our weekly therapy session that we call Investing in Bizarro World. We're going to talk markets. Things are picking up. Summer doldrums are coming to an end. Companies are working. Companies are drilling. Companies are actually putting drill results out that matter. A lot to get to. Soldiers are jumping off of military boats and ships, and we're out of missiles. There's all sorts of stuff going on. But before we get to all that, Nick, the summer is coming to an official end with kids starting to get back to school. How are you doing today, sir?
Maybe they just want to have a nice refreshing swim in this late summertime, Gerardo. I'm doing well. Headed to the lake, as I was telling you, after we record this podcast for the weekend, trying to squeeze it all in with the kids before they get back to school at the end of the month. Doing pretty good. Like to see the markets continuing to improve that we dabble in. And thanks for saying I held it down well. It was pretty in-depth on copper and uranium last week. So back to the banter this week, as it were.
I am well. It's we talked a bit off air. It's been, you know, a month, frankly a year, but a month of milestones, right? We had, we were able to go to Alaska and spent a beautiful week there celebrating my mother-in-law and spreading her ashes at Denali with, you know, my wife and two of our boys and my sister. And that was beautiful. That was an amazing way to celebrate her. And then today's my amazing wife's birthday. So happy birthday to my incredible, incredible wife. She is the glue. If I am the revved up engine of the family, she is most definitely the glue that kind of anchors it all. So happy birthday to her. And then I'll actually be out again next week, folks. I apologize. It'll be the last time in a bit, but taking our youngest to art school in Portland. So dropping him off. So a lot going on, and that's just on the personal side of things. As you know, markets are starting to heat up again. Let's get right into the markets. Gold and silver and copper. The last time you and I did this together 2 weeks ago, we had said it's still copper, then gold, then silver. And we had also talked about, you know, how gold had defended 4,000 really well, but it really needed to get over 4,300 and defend that for a bit before we could see, you know, a potentially sustained breakout. It's done that in spades thus far. Silver, we said it had to defend 55, 56. Again, I was gone last week, but man, we're sitting here at 64, 50 and kissed 66 just a few days ago. So how are you feeling about copper, gold, and silver in that order right now? Is it still the same thing, or are they starting to narrow that gap a little bit between the three of them?
I mean, I think copper is still the strongest, especially here in the U.S. for reasons I discussed last week with the ongoing tariff or non-tariff situation and the building of the inventories here in the U.S. Last week, the first week of August, it was above like $6.90 a pound. It's come down a little bit, but I think copper's chart looks the best overall. You know, it's come down a couple of pennies or a nickel or dime here in the past week. So it has softened from all time highs, but, you know, things don't go straight up. So that's okay. If you pull the copper chart back 3, 6 months, 12 months, a year, for example, it's the strongest looking chart of the three you mentioned for sure. Gold, last time we were together, I was telling you, was improving. It looked to me like it was consolidating at or around, that $4,000 level, and at least wanted to hold that level and not break down, thank goodness, below the 3930 level that I had mentioned a couple of times. It never even got there. In fact, I think it got to like 3940 or something at the lowest wick of the candle. I'm looking at it. Yes. Yeah,
so amazing how those things work, huh?
Five-ish. Yeah, and then sort of bounced around 4,000 a little bit, which is now near-term support is just above that in the 4,100s. And as you mentioned, that 4,300 level, for me, it's, you know, 4,350, 4,375. We're back below that as we speak. Gold had a $50 or $55 down day, but is right back at that 4,350, 4,375 level. Like, and, what else do I want to say about gold? Volatility spiked up just a little bit. So you're going to get wider moves now, you know, maybe more than, you know, $20, $30, $40 a day. You could see gold go to $4,200 one day, $4,500 the next. If it holds that $4,350, $4,375 level, it'll want to touch $4,500 or $4,550 at some point. So the chart is repairing itself. Still a lot of interesting things out there that are affecting it. We had said for a couple of weeks in a row, the beatings will commence until the macro improves. And the macro was either bond yields breaking down, which they have not done, especially in the 10-year and the 30-year. The 2-year softened a little bit, but still overall bullish, I would say. Or the dollar breaking down, which we have gotten, the DXY breaking down below 100, partially due to Mr. Bessent's notepad and the Treasury intervening in the yen market, which I'm sure we'll talk about. I saw it on the list. So, but overall, I think, you know, gold is now taking its cue more from the dollar. I went over that a little bit last week. Spent some time on that in the foundational profits issue that'll be out tomorrow, where the correlations are now, you know, back to more gold inversely correlating more to the dollar and not care about it, not caring about the bond yield so much, which is a good thing for us. And also just moving past hanging on every word of the Fed. This is a long answer, so maybe I should have saved some of this, but I see a lot of hand wringing by the media about Kevin Warsh. And we even mentioned it here a couple of weeks ago, his sort of non-answer or his laissez-faire approach saying the market's going to take care of it. The media really doesn't like that, Gerardo. I don't know if you've noticed, but they like when the Fed tells them things and they have things to write about and things to put in headlines.
Some people like a leash. As I was doing, don't judge them.
as I was doing research for some writing this week, I was going across like Financial Times and Bloomberg and Wall Street Journal, and it's like Kevin Warsh's horrible communication style, Kevin Warsh's confusing, Kevin Warsh's rough start, like not a lot of positive things to say. But the market, I think, has positive things to say. All the S&P has done is hit all new record highs. We just said copper hit record highs. You know, there's a broadening, as I've been talking about the past couple of weeks, not just AI and then tech stocks leading, but other sectors doing well. And so there's an incredible earnings season. So anyway, I'm getting a little bit long in the tooth on the answer. Gold chart looks good. Haven't really looked at silver too close, as I tell you pretty much all the time, but happy to if you'd like. And yeah, commodities are improving. I guess last word is inflation is oscillating. I mean, and you had a softening from 4.2% in May on the monthly inflation number, down to, you know, 3.5% in June. And then the number just came out this week for July, 3.4% or thereabouts. It's going to bounce around there because things are bouncing around. You know, if I look at oil headlines day to day, it's oil. It's still the truce on and off, end of the war. Now we're going to economically squeeze them out, partially because we don't have a lot of missiles to drop, which you mentioned and we'll talk about. But oil up, oil down.
Let's go to a war and use all our missiles. So. Oops.
So it sort of depends on what the oil complex does, but a lot to still watch out there on the inflation side of things, because it's probably going to be pinned there around 3.5% for a while. So long answer.
No, good answer. You took some of my questions because I was going to ask you about PPI and jobs, and then I was going to ask you about Kevin as well. And it's again, we often approach things differently, but we think very similarly on a lot of things. And I was going to absolutely ask you about the two prevailing narratives, where the Bloombergs and the CNBCs and the people that like the leash put on them so they could be guided where they need to go, really do not like the fact that he's not willing to give forward guidance and that he speaks very factually, and that when he does lie to you, if you can, you know, catch the lies, and you can catch the lies if you know the math of the bond market, you know where things are. But even when he does lie to you, he's pretty damn smooth at the lie. Like, he's really good at following the lie with something factual that makes you kind of want to skip a little bit over the lie and just be happy that he told you the truth right after. That takes some skill, right? So I agree 100% on everything that you said. I was going to ask you about September and potentially just the rest of 2026 rate hikes. Not that it's something that I watch every day, because I don't think it's as consequential as Scott Bessent intervening in the Japanese bond market. And we'll talk about that in just a little bit, because we talked about that a few months ago. And I said the one thing that we said something had to give, right? Either the bond market stabilizes, which it has not done, or we're going to get rate hikes to go ahead and tell that bond market to slow down. We also didn't get that. And the one thing that we had said is, look, Bessent was at the side of Soros when they broke the pound. He is a very skilled trader. You may like or not like the administration. You may like or not like his policies. He's a skilled trader. And the thing that we had said a few months ago is, I would not be surprised if he started intervening in the bond markets, right? And it's not necessarily QE. But it's quasi QE, right? It's intervening and doing things to manipulate the accelerating of treasury sales by Japan of U.S. treasuries, not something we can afford right now. So, of course, he was going to intervene. I only mention that because I think that's going to be the policy moving forward here in the U.S. I don't see a bond market that's going to want to cooperate and all of a sudden accept a much lower yield given the debt levels and given what we are doing to address the debt levels. Like, the Trump administration just got rid of the Department of Oversight for Fraud. I wonder why that happened, right? He's like, we don't need a Department of Oversight for Fraud. Get rid of that department. It's like Doge, but like for people that commit fraud. Like, that's out of here. So I see a situation where bonds and yields stay relatively high, close to where they are now, because I don't think the bond vigilantes are going to accept much less. And I think Bessent's going to have to be able to keep finding creative ways to intervene in different bond markets. Japan, I think, was a trial run for the U.S. And we'll see in a couple of months what happens with the midterms coming up. Because, again, I don't think there's a lot of flexibility there. So, long-winded answer to your great answer. It's going to be an interesting couple of months. What do you think, Kevin, and I haven't looked at the odds lately, has any room to hike now in September, given the fact that jobs came in worse than we thought, the revisions were worse than we thought, inflation is starting to cool down at least up to a month ago, which is the data that we're getting now, right? We'll see what kind of an effect $80 oil or $85 oil has on that inflation number here over the next several months. But where do the odds sit right now? What do you have on that, Nick? Have you looked lately?
Yeah, I'm looking right at it. And basically, it's no change. So that's what you got in June. That's what you got in July. No change, no change. The current rate is 3.5% to 3.75%. That's the federal funds rate. And the odds of no change continue to go up for September. So a month ago, they were about 50-50 of no change or a hike. When I was writing earlier this week, they were at 59% chance of no change. And I just pulled them up now just in the past day, because I was looking at them yesterday. They're up to 65% chance of no hike in September, and only a 34% chance of a quarter point hike, 0% chance of a cut. And October has been going in the same direction. So it was a month ago. You were actually slightly ahead on a quarter point hike. It was like 43 or 44% for a hike and like 41% for no hike. And then, you know, some small marginal percent for a double quarter, half a point hike, essentially. That has been going the other way in the past couple of weeks. Now you're over a 50% chance, which is the greatest probability on the chart, of no action again in October. Now, inside the Fed, there is dissent. You had three people vote for a hike the last time, which is, you know, I think the Financial Times billed it as a family fight or something like that, with the, you know, growing opposition to doing nothing. But the rates, as I just said, are of no moves for the next 2 months. And then again, there's no meeting in November. And then out to December is a little bit too far to look, but the market's currently pricing in one quarter point rate hike for the December meeting. You know, jobs will give them cover not to do anything. It was a weak July. The jobs report, I had the number here a second ago. I think 23,000 was the number. Yeah. Unexpected drop in July. Non-farm payrolls fell by 23,000 jobs. So we were able to point to that and say we can't you know, increase rates, the economy is tightening, growth slowed a little bit, you know. June, yeah, the second quarter number just came out. Still not setting the world on fire in terms of economic growth. And so I think you're just going to get non-action for the next couple of months here. What else did you ask about? Oh, you were talking about the bond market and Bessent. Yeah, that's really what I was saying in the in the first part of the of this podcast. That's what's led the dollar softer is this intervention, right? By definition, if the DXY is, you know, a currency index, a basket of currencies or whatever, the, or the dollar weighted against a basket of currencies, if your government is intervening, by the way, with treasury dollars, which are your tax dollars, because that's not the Fed, that is the Treasury Department, to buy another country's currency, which is like the largest intervention since Fukushima, I believe. Then by definition, if you make that other currency go up, the dollar is weaker in comparison. And so that's why you've had the falling of the dollar from that, you know, 100, 101 level down to 99, starting to stabilize there a bit. But they get a side benefit, which is worth mentioning, which is higher asset prices, which is good for the administration heading into the midterms. Yep. Because, and we'll talk about this later, the midterm votes have been all over the place with either Trump-backed candidates continuing to dominate or Democratic Socialists of America. So back into the sort of tribal respective corners, as it were. So Trump wants higher asset prices, and you're getting them, as I mentioned. All-time high in stocks, copper, gold ticking up. And so a little bonus there for the asset owners. He was also talking about capital gains this week. So he's definitely desperate for those wallet voters here in the next couple of months.
Listen, I think it's surprising, not surprising, right, that we had odds of, and you read the odds, right? 50, 60, 65%, or definitely rate hikes, you know, if not last month, definitely by September. And now all of a sudden that's gone the other way. And with them not having a November meeting, somehow they figured out how to punt till after the midterms. Imagine that, Nick. What a coinkydink, right? Just like it's a coinkydink that Todd Blanche is now your attorney general, folks. That was voted in overnight while everybody slept or figured out how they were going to pay the bills.
Like four in the morning.
Yeah. So while America was figuring out how to keep their kids safe and pay the bills, the people that are elected by us to keep, you know, things orderly and to provide law and order and to help keep our kids safe and to help, you know, make sense of this crazy, crazy world, decided to vote in the person that was in charge of defending Donald Trump against the release of the Epstein files. I'd like to remind everybody that only one person has been arrested for that. Ghislaine Maxwell was arrested for trafficking and raping minors all around the country and the world. And yet we know not who, and we know not to who, and we have had not one single arrest outside of her, but she does have plush conditions and a puppy and yoga classes in a minimum security prison here in Texas, I believe. So there is that. That is your new attorney general, folks. And so however you feel about the left or the right, and they're both getting more extreme, highlighted by the socialists on the Democratic side, that think that's the campaign to run on, they're going to find out. Or the people on the right that keep thinking that some of these things are just going to go away, like running out of missiles in the middle of a war, or sailors on the USS Lincoln. I think reports of up to six of them now here in recent months jumping overboard because they've been deployed for something like 250 straight days without like landing anywhere, like seeing land, period. And there's reports of conditions that are just miserable and food rations that aren't humane. And this isn't like conspiracy theory stuff. This is stuff that's being reported on mainstream outlets from both the left and the right, with seemingly no good answers from this administration. So whichever tribe you subscribe to, or hopefully you subscribe to, you know, just critical thinking and knowing that both sides are going to do what's best for them, and that behind the scenes, they likely plan a lot of this stuff together. It's getting more polarized and it's getting more extreme on each side, which, look, I'm going to give you a long answer now. Chris Curl had an excellent piece over at Bizarro World. If you go to bizarroworld.com, I read a piece earlier by him, and he talked about, you know, the different outcomes and the different potential outcomes. And he talked about, you know, he could see a situation where AI, you know, could be brought in and become like the impartial judge of policy and decision making because it would remove the corruption if the agents in charge of the AI were coded properly and the safeguards were in place, right? And that's a whole nother conversation we'll have in a little bit about flock cameras and all of that. But I thought it was a brilliant piece by Chris. You guys should all go check that out at bizarroworld.com. If you have a second, he laid out the case really, really well for where we are politically, how seemingly we have less and less good choices on either side or in the middle, like the middle, the libertarians, right? Which I call the middle. And I tend to lean more libertarian, right? It's some issues traditionally, I'm a more Democrat leaning, and some issues traditionally, like fiscal responsibility and Second Amendment, I'm a more traditionally Republican, but neither one of those parties represent any of what the traditions used to be, right? You can't find a fiscally responsible Republican right now. It's maybe Rand Paul, but again, he voted for funding Israel, and meanwhile, we don't have conditions that are proper for our sailors on the USS Lincoln, forcing them to take extreme action in order to get away. Crazy times. It's a bizarre world out there, folks. That's my rant. I missed y'all. I needed to get that one off.
Yeah. I don't know where to take it from there. Let me see if I can pick up the baton and run with it. So I guess I'll start with the AI. And Chris, he'll be on the podcast later this month, the 27th, I believe it is. That's the day my kids go back from school, back to school. So you can have that conversation with him. He loves talking about the politics and the fourth turning and the lack of representation and the choices and all that sort of stuff. The AI is getting wild in many capacities. I don't know if you saw, but there was a pretty big shakeup at Google over the past couple of weeks where like three of their top folks who were like, and are industry leaders in the AI space left or defected or however you want to put it, because they're starting their own company. Now, Google does have some involvement in the new company. I think they've given them some hardware and some compute power. But the new company they're trying to form, and this is like the head guy of AI at Google. I could find his name if you really wanted me to in a second. But the company they're starting is called Discovery Loop. And his name is Jeff Dean, a longtime Google employee central to the development of the company's AI strategy. So him and a couple of other folks are starting this company called Discovery Loop. And they're basically using the AI to teach the AI or to teach machine learning so it can go off and do its own thing, either, you know, create new ways to manufacture chips or make scientific breakthroughs, especially as it relates to medicine. So training the AI with or training the machine learning with AI so it goes out and does the scientific process on its own and continues to improve it. So we're getting real close, if not to the singularity, to a place where this AI is getting out of control. And you should talk to Chris because he'll have much more insights than I do. You know, we've been talking about this. You know, the big promotion we've had out there for Digital Dispatch is about just that, applying the AI to robots and hardware, and OpenAI or ChatGPT will be out soon with its first device. It's like a little hockey puck style thing that you can carry around in your hand, sort of like Alexa, but it's meant for you to carry around in the palm of your hand as you go about your either daily life or go about your home life, to be able to ask it things and interact with it. So yeah, we're getting real close, man, on all sorts of stuff. And then I don't know, on the politics and the fourth turning, it's been super interesting. You know, you get these enclaves where the DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America, are winning in and around here is in Washington, Seattle, in and around Denver.
Almost won in Wisconsin. That was close.
And enclaves like that. I'm going to get there. Yeah, obviously, Mandami has been the governor of New York for a while. We'll see how that experiment plays out. I talked a little bit about his grocery stores last week and how he's already getting pushback to that. I don't know if you caught that. But
our grocery stores, we're funding them.
Yeah, and like the immigrant grocers and folks aren't having it. They're already like forming coalitions to fight it because they don't want to, you know, have to compete against government-run grocery stores. So very interesting experiment. But that was that's the other side of the coin, right? And that's why, you know, it's interesting. Like the lady in Wisconsin, I had her name up. Am I going to be able to find it in time? It's right here. Where is it? Doot, doot, doot. Oh, come on, Nick. Two more clicks back. What was her name? Francesca Hong. She was the one that was running sort of like a blast from the past and the woke stuff, right? Like a AOC type person, like bartender, state representative, but super woke, and was campaigning with the gentleman whose name I just clicked through, Hassan Piker, right? This, self-pronounced socialist who's making appearances dressed as Mao Zedong. Like, that was the chick that was running for the Democratic governor primary
Of
in
Wisconsin, of all places.
Wisconsin.
We're not
And
talking about, we're
it
talking middle America, folks. Just by the way, I'm a Chicago kid, right? Like.
yeah, so and she, this chick wanted to ban Thanksgiving, like all sorts of stuff, right? And it's like, there was a bit of an uproar, and it got a lot of media attention because it's like, oh man, is this who they're going to nominate in Wisconsin to be the governor? She ended up losing, to a more conventional Democrat. I don't have his name here. I think his last name is Crowley. But it's interesting, I was in Wisconsin over the summer, and there was we had a political presentation about. That not
Politics of
socialism, but
mining, yeah.
the politics of mining and how Wisconsin is a very purple state and it goes back and forth. So we'll see how it goes. They might end up just electing the Republican candidate. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. But yeah, good to see the socialism get combated a bit, because that was one of the things I was worried about and was talking about last week, was sort of this rising up of socialism. And the other thing I was reading is, the Democrats, as we know, have sort of lost the narrative, right? They don't really have a good plan. They don't have a lot of strong candidates. And so they're basically field testing all these different types of candidates. We talked about the main guy a couple of weeks ago, not the main, not the central guy, but the state guy, who had to drop out of the race, et cetera. And they're trying to see what resonates outside of the socialism, which it doesn't seem like. One point on that, and now I'm doing the ranting and hogging the mic, but it's not your traditional. This isn't being embraced by the worker. It's being pitched that way. This is for the worker or the common man or et cetera. But if you look at the actual numbers, the poll results, and who votes for these socialist candidates, it's college educated folks who are making money. The best way I can put it, and this might be a little crass, but it's highly educated folks who don't make a lot of money. Like, they spend a lot on their education, and maybe they're experts in their field, but they're in low paying fields. Like, they didn't catch the asset increase, or they didn't participate in capitalism, or they're not, involved in the markets. They're academics. Those are the ones who further these candidates and who want them to get into office. It's either guilt, or it's academic, but it's not. Like, Joe the plumber isn't out there saying, like, oh yeah, like, I love these socialist policies. And that's why the lady didn't win in Wisconsin, right? And those rural type of enclaves and a heavy farming state, et cetera. And that's good to see. It's being rejected by the mainstream. So I was going to say something else, but I forget. And then on the other side, on the Republican side, it's, more of the same, with the Trump-blessed candidates continuing to do well and having to bow the knee or bend the knee to get his blessing to do well in their races. So all that to say, as you were saying, not a lot of good choices out there on either side. And when you do get a candidate who does well, like Massey, who we've talked about, it's, he ends up getting, forced out or run against. So it's going to be an interesting fall on the political front, as always, and interested to see how some of these votes
Again,
play out.
worth reminding everybody, Massey got run out for two main reasons. One, he wanted to know who raped, killed, and tortured children and wanted them to be accountable, which still hasn't happened. And two, because AIPAC didn't like the fact that he wasn't willing to bend to his knee to Trump and Israel, and just blank check everything. He wanted, ironically, what Trump wanted and campaigned on this last time. He wanted to put America first, y'all. That's why he got ran out of the Republican Party and his seat. Welcome to 2026 Bizarro World, everybody. It's nuts out there. Not a lot of good choices. I don't see the choices getting better. I don't see them getting more practical. And look, at the end of the day, just to put, a finer, a last point on it, not a finer point, a final point on it. The rich and the wealthy, and especially the very wealthy, are being worked for, and they have the lobbyists and they have the people in office that are going to maintain asset prices elevated for a sustainable period of time. The tax benefits will continue. The corruption will continue until somebody puts a stop to it. And when you have an administration, that is literally selling, like, you can't even do this in the newsletter, like, business, folks. It's illegal. Like, you can't get news beforehand and then act on it. Like, it's illegal, right? Like, and they're actually doing this in public. It's like, for 100 grand, you could see what I'm posting about the markets a little bit ahead of time. And look, kudos to whoever decided to sue the Trump administration for this. There actually is a lawsuit that
It
was
was a press
filed. There you
organization.
go. That was filed by a press organization out of New York, if I'm not mistaken, wanting to take this to court. And they're going, how in the heck is this even legal? Like, you have Iran calling for an investigation into Kushner's dealings over in the Middle East, saying he's in, they're insider trading all of this information and they're privy to high-level negotiations with us. And all they're doing is playing both sides. So we no longer want to negotiate with you in good faith. Because, oh, by the way, we think you're out of missiles and we're just going to wait you out. Because G.I. Joe Hegseth over here, is off running. Well, let me say this, because I'm not a part of the military. The 30-something or 40-something top brass generals that were fired early on, it's making more sense to me now. And it made a little sense then, but there's no way in hell that those generals and those combat experience, top level personnel were going to go along with something that they were doing games on, right? War games on, and modeling how that would play out. This is exactly what they were warning about 6, 7 months ago. And so, not a coincidence that G.I. Joe Hegseth decided, well, if you won't agree with me, then you got to go, because me and my whatever rank he worked himself up to once upon a time knows better. And it's just, again, not practical. I want a strong U.S. military. I want to have the strongest U.S. military. I want to have more than, a couple of months worth of missiles on hand just in case. Like, I want all those things. I want good fiscal policy and monetary policy, and I don't want kids getting, assaulted and trafficked and all the things. And that seems to be like the controversial take right now, which is absolutely insane, absolutely bizarro.
It's crazy. I remember one of the things I was going to say doesn't really relate to what you were saying, and maybe a little bit, but I was saying the Democratic candidates, they're trying different things to see what sticks. And outside of the socialism, one of the messages that continues to work for them is eat the rich, right? This the rich need to pay their fair share, which again, I don't agree with either. And I could point to lots of things and have written about how the rich do pay their fair share, especially the working rich, you and I, and likely lots of folks who listen to this podcast who, exceed the threshold, a couple hundred thousand, 500, 600,000 in income a year, but aren't like, billionaires living off loans from their equity positions and things like that, right? There's a difference. And so, that doesn't fly either. What else was I going to say? Interesting, and I'll get to the missiles in a second. Interesting that some of these candidates, including Abdul El-Sayed, who won the Democratic primary, I think in
Michigan, I
Michigan, in
believe.
Michigan, yeah, that's right, for senator, is 41 years old. This is prime millennial territory, born in 1984. Classic fourth turning age bracket for this younger cohort, born 1982, 1983 to just about, but wherever you want to cut it off, 1999, 2000, starting to get into these leadership positions, top 50 politicians in the country in terms of the Senate, for example. So, the fourth turning, she definitely turns. The Trump Truth Social stuff is crazy, man. Like, your president can't be
Yo.
allowed to sell information ahead of time that he's posted on there, and he'll lose his suit back to checks and balances, which we were talking about with courts a couple of weeks ago in the Supreme Court. Like, you can't have, what the president says is in the public domain. It's a presidential proclamation, or however you want to word that. Like, you can't be selling advanced access to that. And there's plenty of hedge funds that are willing to buy that because Trump is market moving, even though he's, you know, in the last 2 years of his presidency. And on that point, side note, like, I was getting pretty tired of the Sunday ceasefires. Like, that became pretty damn predictable. You know, as I would sit down on my Sunday evening after dinner and start to look at the markets that were opening up in Asia and Australia. Oh, it's a Sunday ceasefire, so we could spike the markets on Monday. It's like, come on, man. But anyway, to the missiles, which is a very real thing. And you were talking about this a couple of weeks ago. It's now come out and in long stories in the New York Times and other outlets, with generals talking and other people inside the military, you know, given numbers on condition of anonymity. And so I'm looking at this New York Times article right here, and it says, it could take more than 2 years for the United States to replenish the more than 1,500 Patriot air defense interceptor missiles that have been used in the Iran war. And so that's the first sentence. The second sentence, which is where I was like, oh, shit. The current U.S. inventory of those missiles is fewer than 1,700. So do that math. We just blasted 1,500 of them. That was half of what we had, if we've only got 1,700 left, right? So we've blasted half our Patriot air defense missiles in the past, whatever that is. We're in the eighth month. We started at the end of the second month. So 5-6 months, we went through half our Patriot air defense missiles. It has implications for all sorts of stuff.
China and Taiwan. We'll talk about that in a second.
Well, I was going to get there. I was going to talk about Ukraine first, because there were some missiles that flew into Ukraine the other day that killed, it was either 7 or 17 civilians. And one of the reasons why is because they have fewer air defense missiles, because we've been using them. The other thing is, yeah, China and Taiwan and Russia and North Korea, we use that to negotiate from a position of, if not strength, at least knowing that the U.S. can't get into some, you know, another prolonged conflict with them.
We can't even finish this one.
I'm not calling for anything, but, you know, if Russia wanted to, you know, continue to be its pesky war self, or if China did want to do something with Taiwan, or, you know, on down the line, it just has effects with, you know, international policy and statesmanship. And U.S. lives, frankly, because what happens is, if you do have to have a conflict, or this conflict continues, you can't fight from afar. We have lots of other bombs, but you have to get closer in order to deploy them, because we've already used a lot of our long-range missiles. So you have to get the planes and therefore your troops closer to harm's way, especially in the case of China, which has much better air defenses than Iran. So, yeah, implications on down the line. And then, you know, closer to what you and I do, I mean, where are they going to get the metals and minerals to, you know, replace these munitions and laser-guided missile systems that require all the things we talk about every week, the galliums, the germaniums, the telluriums, all that sort of stuff, right? And then what did happen after the podcast last week, because the lunch was on Friday, was, you know, $3 billion of announcements from the Trump administration as he had a meeting with the heads of mining companies.
I call it, not to cut you off, but miners go to Washington. Miners with an E, not an O, everybody.
Well, Washington goes to the miners in the other way. So that's how
I knew
it goes.
You'd pick that one up. Sorry.
Yeah, so it was $3 billion, some direct investments or loans or protections into, you know, scandium companies, tungsten companies, all sorts of, you know, metals that are on the critical minerals list. And then money into schools, which is something we've talked about as well, to get the expertise for mining engineering and metallurgy, rare earth separation, which we have absolutely no expertise on here in the United States. So at least he realizes, or the administration realizes, that this is a pretty serious problem. And I mean, you know, Thursday and Friday and Monday were great days in the market for some of those names. I mean, and some of them might not be the best companies, which that's a whole other topic we should talk about one day, is how the government chooses these. I mean, I saw I think it's called Westwater Resources or something. And I know that company because it's one that I would never invest in. It's like a graphite deposit in Alabama or something. And I was like, holy shit. And the company's up, you know, like 75% in a week or whatever it is. So I guess I did mention that a bit last week, but yeah, the government not great at doing diligence on these companies. So still a lot of room to run is how I interpret that for the companies that do have quality projects that they're exploring. And
no, look, developing. It's early days, and I will commend this administration on that front. I've said this continuously, like they've done a really good job of putting their foot on the gas. And, you know, the Colorado School of Mine is going to get like $180 million because I believe they had, you know, enrollment for engineering programs was down from like 1500 students to like 650 students or some number like that. And look, folks, if we're going to put any kind of dent into this Chinese monopoly in critical metals and strategic metals, including gold and silver, it's going to take a lot more than 650 or 700 engineers in school at one time to even begin to have the human capital, the intellectual capital, to be able to scale this out. And so, that could be a whole nother conversation. Maybe we'll have it another day. But on that front, kudos to the administration executing on that front. Their stock picking for their personal portfolios is amazing. Coincidentally, their stock picking for selecting who gets grants and who gets loans leaves something to be desired. But again, we'll have that conversation another day, and maybe run down through some of the names, the companies, and why Nick and I wouldn't allocate capital to those companies, but why the government maybe decided that's where the dollars should flow. But anyhow, I digress. Look, that's been a lot because there's a lot going on, and I was gone for a week. I missed y'all. So is there anything else you want to get off your chest, Mr. Hodge?
I'm only going to tell you about Jim the Barber, and then, yeah, we'll get out of here a little bit earlier and much less than
we'll get to the premium portion of the podcast.
And it correlates to the fourth turning, and, you know, for that to happen, for those 40-year-olds to come up, the 80 and 90-year-olds have to pass away. And Jim the Barber passed away this past week. You don't know who that is, Gerardo, nor do the listeners, but he was my childhood barber. He owned Jim's Barber Shop in Elkton, Maryland, where everyone, and I mean everyone, got their hair cut. He was 95 years old, a former Marine, and he ran that barbershop. I think I was trying to look at the sign on Google Maps, but I couldn't get the exact date. But it had to be for 40 or 50 years. And, you know, it was one of these small town barbershops with three barbers, and everyone knew everybody. You would go in there, no numbers. Everyone just kept track of like who came in first and what the order was. Games on the shelf that you would play, like the horseshoes chained together with the ring where you would have to get it out, or balancing nails on top of another nail while you waited, like classic barbershop. So I can only imagine how big the funeral is going to be, but the barbershop still exists. Jim the Barber isn't there anymore, obviously. But I remember when I started going there, haircuts were $6 cash only. And I have to say, I imagine they're much more expensive than that now. I haven't been to Jim's Barbershop in 10 or so years. But here at the barber where I get my haircut, I believe haircuts are $35 or $40. So 2-3% inflation be damned. Haircuts are up 300-400% in the past 30 years for sure. And goodbye to Jim the Barber.
Salute to him. We should all be so lucky to get 95 years, and good for him for making it a cash only business. I respect it. Thank you for your service, sir. Well said. Let's get into the premium portion of the podcast. I hope everybody has a phenomenal, phenomenal week. I am Gerardo Del Real, along with Mr. Nick Hodge. This was the 376th episode of our weekly therapy session, which was needed once again, that we call Investing in Bizarro World. Have a great one out there, folks. And keep writing in. We love that, by the way.